Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have an amazing show for you this evening. The legendary four-star general, General Lloyd W. Fig Newton, is here, and we are going to talk about so many things from his background, his time in Vietnam and with the Thunderbirds and beyond, so many things. I am grateful that he's able to join us this evening. And so we'll get to him in just a minute. Before we get started, just a few things. First of all, things are absolutely booming in Social Flight with the holidays approaching. We've got things like Santa fly-ins and hangar dances and all sorts of things. So be sure to check all that out on socialflight.com. and the free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. In addition, if the weather doesn't work for you to get out there and fly, we have all sorts of online events and courses. We've got our FAA learning system where you can take on-demand courses for wings credit. If you're a mechanic, you can participate in the Aviation Maintenance Technician Awards Program. Or if you're an IA, you can get your continuing education completely free, your 8 hours of continuing education for your IA renewal, all on Social Flight. It's very simple and straightforward. In addition, we have our Fly to Win Challenge. You take the mobile app, you check in at an airport, and even one check-in and you are entered in to win. We just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset, and we're giving away another one on February 1st. So get the mobile app, just one word, Social Flight, in the App Store. Get out there and you could win that Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Aspen Avionics and the amazing Evolution Max primary and multifunction flight displays. We fly behind an Evolution 2000 system with both the primary flight display and the multifunction display in our Bonanza. Absolutely love it. We do so much flying. It helps for heavy instrument flying or just long distance cross-country work, strategic weather planning. It's fantastic. Be sure to check those out. And there are some great promotions that they are offering right now. In addition, we're building one of them into that Mustang you see right there behind me is our primary display. Your glass cockpits arrive, so check it out with Aspen. And thank them for supporting Social Flight, please. Okay, on to tonight's guest. General Lloyd Fig Newton began his Air Force career in the heat of battle, flying 269 combat missions in the F-4D Phantom during the Vietnam War. Following the war, he served as the first African-American member of the elite United States Air Force Thunderbirds Demonstration Squadron. Following his tour with the Thunderbirds, General Newton served as the Air Force Congressional Liaison Officer with the United States House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. He's commanded three wings and an air division and held numerous staff positions. And from 93 to 95, he was Director of Operations with the United States Special Operations Command. General Newton is a command pilot with more than 4,000 flying hours in the T-37, T-38, F-4, F-15, F-16, C-12, and F-117 stealth fighter. His final role in the Air Force was commanding the United States Air Force Air Education and Training Command, consisting of 13 bases, more than 43,000 active duty members, and 14,000 civilians. Prior to his retirement, General Newton joined Pratt & Whitney as the Vice President of Business Development for Military Engines, and his book, Living the Dream, tells the story of breaking the bonds of segregation and disenfranchisement to become one of our nation's most accomplished military leaders. I am thrilled to have him here with us tonight on Social Flight Live. Please welcome General Lloyd Fig Newton. General Newton, welcome to the show.
Well, hello, Jeff. How are you?
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us this evening. I just want to dive in here because your background reads so long, it could have taken up the whole show just doing your intro. So take me back to the child that started all of this. I mean, did you come from an aviation family? Did you come from a military background? What was it that started this journey and you think gave you this kind of the seeds to become as accomplished as you are?
Did not come from an aviation family. As a matter of fact, no one in my family really knew very much about flying at all, other than the fact we saw airplanes, you know, in the sky kind of things. I grew up on a small farm down in the lower part of the state of South Carolina. And again, I was on a farm, a small farm that my parents owned. And it wasn't until, you know, I finished high school here, a little town called Ridgeland, South Carolina. And from there, I went to school at Tennessee State in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, ever since I was a small kid, though, I always wanted to be in the military. I wasn't focused on flying at that time because I never imagined I would have the opportunity to go and fly an airplane, you know. But I got to Tennessee State and they had a flying program, an aviation program. And so that's when I got introduced to flying. I had my first flight ever in an aircraft when I was there in my freshman year of college. And from that, it was in a J3 Piper Cub. I'll always remember that. It was on a Saturday morning. And once I was airborne, when I got on the ground, I was hooked and I've been with it ever since. So that's kind of how I got into aviation. And again, once it gets into your blood, it's very, very hard to get it out. It's still with me.
I can imagine. I mean, do you know what it was that kind of had you as a young child thinking military all the way so young?
Yeah, I saw it as an opportunity to, you know, get away from my little hometown and explore the world. And I also had a cousin who was in the United States Army. And not only did I adore him, he was a hero to so many of us. He was one of the first group of folks to reach the rank, a new rank of Sergeant Major in the United States Army. And so when Lee would come home, I mean, you know, it seemed like the whole town knew it in no time at all. He was that popular. And so he was a role model for me. And that was a good path, I thought, to go and serve the country as well as and build a good life for myself.
How wonderful. And the classic kind of like farm boy.
Yes.
You know, looking to grow beyond that. So tell me a little bit about, you mentioned in Tennessee State that you started in the aviation program there and that kind of led you on that journey towards the military. Tell me what you remember about your flight training and kind of the parts you liked, the parts maybe you didn't like, or what you really took to very well.
Well, because I was taking these aviation, I was in the aviation program and taking these various aviation courses, I can remember we were studying in the classroom how you cover the wings of an aircraft. And this was with cloth wings, you know, wasn't the metal wings that we see in traditionally in newer airplanes today. So our instructor took us out to the airport, walked up to that J3 Piper Cub, took his knife, jammed the hole right in the wing and ripped it and say, okay, now you're going to repair that. Then we're going to fly this airplane. I mean, we were startled when he did that, you know, but it taught us that, hey, this is really possible. So sure enough, our class over a semester really rebuilt that wing and, put all of the fabric on it, put all the glue on it, repainted it, the whole bit. And so, you know, that was exciting stuff for me. You know, I was used to using my hands. Why? Because I came off of the farm. And that was just really, really exciting stuff. You know, we mentioned the farm. And if you look back through aviation history, there are a number of pilots and aviators and maintenance folks who came right off of farms and went right into flying. So it was pretty straightforward.
There's an honesty about it and a hard work kind of ethic and the ability to fix things and work on machinery and understand how things tick that just seems to make sense. But then there's that image of someone who's working on the family farm sort of yearning to do something different and staring up at the sky and seeing an airplane go by, that's just classic.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, being here in the low country of South Carolina, there were several, you know, military bases around, namely Charleston Air Force Base is only, you know, roughly 85 or so miles away. There was Savannah, which is even only 30 or so miles away. And there were airplanes flying out of there. So, you know, I'm standing in the field watching these, you know, machines fly over me and just imagining one day, well, maybe I'll get an opportunity to ride in one of these, you know. And then when I was talking with my cousin who was in the Army, he'd talk about jumping out of these airplanes. Well, all of that was just a real thrill for me. I wanted to be a part of that, you know, kind of thing. So, it came pretty natural to want to do it. And then once I left Earth and was airborne on that Saturday morning, it was just an amazing, exhilarating experience of being airborne, you know, and again, it just stayed with me.
How wonderful. And, you know, not a lot of military pilots that I've spent time with have that connection to something as basic and general aviation as a J-3 Cub. And so tell me a little bit about how going through that program, what that meant when you started your military training.
Yeah, I mean, it became very helpful because I'd already, you know, the very first airplane in my military flight training was an aircraft called a T-41, and it was a Cessna 172. It was, you know, they took some of the equipment off of it and all of that, made it a little different, beefed up the landing gears a little bit, that kind of stuff. But it's the same aircraft. Well, I had already flown the 150 and the 172 at Tennessee State, and I can remember one event where my instructor was a guy by the name of Cecil Ryan. And Cecil Ryan was one of the civilian instructors for the Tuskegee Airmen down in Tuskegee, Alabama, for the World War II pilots. Anyway, he was he led the aviation department at Tennessee State. And I was out flying with him one day. And, you know, I was all excited about being airborne and all of that. And he happened to look over and looked at me and he said, let me have the control. So he took the controls, and I don't know what altitude we were, 3,000 feet or something. He took the aircraft, jammed the controls forward. I went right into the top of the cockpit, and then he pulled the controls back, slammed me back down in my seat, and he said, now fasten that seatbelt. You know, I have never forgotten fastening a seatbelt, no matter where I am from then until this moment. He taught me a very valuable lesson, you know.
So, oh, man.
That was certainly one I remember from going through the program at Tennessee State.
There's something to be said for that old school way of teaching.
Yep. Never to be forgotten. Even when I get in the car, you know, I'm looking for the seatbelt immediately. So being sure that my belt was fastened in an automobile was not a problem for me after that experience.
That's fantastic. Were you, when you began your military training, based on the fact that you'd flown the Cub, were you the only one that actually knew how to use rudder pedals?
No. There were a number of other folks who had some civilian flight experience by the time I went through flight school out to the south of Phoenix, Arizona at Williams Air Force Base. It's closed now. But there are a number of other pilots, students in my classmates, that had some civilian flight time before we got there. Yeah.
Wow.
So it was very helpful.
So take me through a little bit in the training, because as you mentioned, you started with T-41, the basically 172. And then where did you go straight there to like the tweet? Where'd you go from there?
Yeah, from there, you spent about 6 weeks in the T-41, then graduate from there, go to the T-37. And you spent about 5 to 6 months there. Flight school is what we call, it's 53 weeks. So we call it 53 weeks in a year back at that time. And so spent about five or so months in the T-37, getting all of the basic maneuvers, get to understand jet engines and all of that. And then you transition to the T-38 for about the last five and a half months. of the training, which got you into a supersonic flight and very maneuverable kind of aircraft. So that was really neat.
That's fantastic. Very, very cool. So the tweet just for everybody, the T-37 is the twin engine.
It's a twin engine Cessna, built by Cessna.
Yeah. That makes a lot of noise.
Yes. I mean, it'll hurt your ears. If you're within seemingly a mile of it, it's going to hurt your ears. Yeah. It was a very loud aircraft, the way the intakes were designed and all of that, unfortunately. So you always have to have, when you're out on the flight line, is have your air protection on. That was one of the first things when you got the T-37, it issued you was head protection, air protection to go out on the flight line. But yes.
Wow. Okay, so from there, where did you go? What aircraft did you evolve to?
After T-38s, I graduated from flight school, and out of flight school, I was selected to go into F-4 Phantoms from there. And so I trained for my combat training out at George Air Force Base, right outside of Victorville, California, out over the Mojave Desert. That was about 5.5 months or so. And then to survival school up at Fairchild in Washington, state of Washington, near Spokane, Washington, as a matter of fact, and then right into Vietnam. So, you know, roughly 20 months from the time I left Tennessee State, here I am in the middle of Vietnam at Da Nang Air Base. Real shock for a young, you know, South Carolina boy out of the cornfields of South Carolina, and here I am standing in the middle of Vietnam.
Oh man,
combat.
So before you did that, obviously you moved all the way up to the Phantom.
Yes.
What was that evolution like? And then tell me what it was like to land in country and do it.
Yeah, well, in training in the Phantom, I mean, that was a whole different world. And you know, those basic skills that you learned in initial flight training, now you just, you know, transition those over to the Phantom. But really in the Phantom, we're going to learn combat capability and combat maneuvering of the aircraft to do a couple of different things. Number one, because we have both a ground, what we call an air-to-ground mission, as well as an air-to-air mission. And so, you know, we're going to the bombing range several times a week, as well as then you move to a different phase where we're into air-to-air combat, where you're engaging with other aircraft in the air, including for us. We were fortunate of being in California because we would meet up with the Navy out of San Diego, and we would then, you know, compete against their airplanes, which gave you a more critical combat training opportunity. So it was pretty intense, no question about that.
So tell me then about, you had that training, at least you weren't dumped completely with nothing into it.
No. We were trained when not to the degree that which we are trained for combat today. And we can talk about that later because we learned a lot of things coming out of Vietnam.
So tell me about then your initial missions in Vietnam and what it was like with the older method of training to ramp up to be able to fly effectively and safely.
Yeah, sure. So when you first get to Vietnam, you know, you're going to have some training or have some flights with very experienced folks, what we call folks that have already been in country for several months. And I can remember my first combat mission was over North Vietnam, up around Quang Ky, which is up in what we call Route Pack 2, probably, I don't know, 50, 60 miles north of the DMZ and of North Vietnam. And so I looked up and my name is on the schedule to go fly. And so, okay, so where's the mission today? You're going up north. I'm thinking my first mission is going to be down south, you know, where I'm going and serve with and support troops in combat or go as escort the ranch hand aircraft or something. Oh no. They said, Newton, you're going up north. I'm going up there for the first time with a guy by the name of Rex Hammack, Major Rex Hammack. Big Newton is a second lieutenant. Rex Hammack is a major, and he's going on his 94th mission up north. Newton is going on his number one Uno mission up north. Okay. So that was a, and I would say, you know, a lot of folks, oh, you know, I was in combat, you know, it wasn't that frightening. No, it was scary. Because we went in and did our first dive bomb mission and pulled off. And Rex says to me, he said, "You see those little puffs of smoke out there?" And I go, "Yeah." He said, "You know what that is?" I said, "No, puffs of smoke." He said, "No, that's 37 millimeter smoke." So that was gunfire coming after us. You know, we didn't get hit or anything on that mission, but it certainly gets your attention when you know folks are shooting at you and you can see the bullets exploding with these little puffs of smoke right next to your airplane. So yeah, wow. It gets your attention. No question about that.
What were most of your missions, bombing runs, or did you have any other direct engagement?
All of my missions were basically bombing runs, except I flew 79 mission over North Vietnam before we stopped going up north, except if there were some enemy aircraft coming across the DMZ headed south, then if we were on alert, we'd launch from there and go to meet the enemy. But while I was there, I did not engage and didn't have the opportunity to engage with any MiG aircraft at that point. It was before I got there where a number of the pilots had been engaging with MiG aircraft up north. And after Tet and after the time that I left, I was there in April of 68 to April of 69. So as we got near the end of the war, in 70 through about 72, that's when a lot of flights during that period of time were engaged up north.
Mm. What my understanding is that most of that extreme danger was from, as you mentioned, anti-aircraft fire, but also also SAM, surface-to-air missile situations. Tell me about some of your missions or what was.
Well, we were trained with the type of formation we were flying in the F-4 Phantom to defeat the SAM launches. So we would be roughly 2,000 feet apart, flights of two, and eyes out all the time, and particularly during the daytime, so you can see if a SAM is launched. Sometimes you get some warning from airborne airplanes that we had that knew and could pick up that SAMs were being launched. But if you see one launch, you just watch it until it commits on you. And then we'd start a very steep dive. And the missile then can't turn the corner to come down to get you if you do it right. If you don't see it, chances are you're going to get hit. Okay. So we lost a number of folks like that. If you don't execute the maneuver correctly, you could get hit. And so,
I always thought that the notification was electronic, not that you were expected to see it visually.
Well, some of it was electronically, and even in the F-4, we had an instrument that would normally pick it up, and it would have a strobe that would be pointing to something on that radar, and many times it was a SAM. And so that would help you, but it wasn't always perfect. And even at that point, now you got to look out there and still find it. The radar won't give, and what we call the raw gear wouldn't give you information so that you'll know when to execute that maneuver that I was just talking about. Wow. You got to look out there and find it, and you see this big scary ball of fire coming at you. And if it's at nighttime, the whole sky is all lit up. You then execute the maneuver to defeat the missile, and the missile then just goes past you and really explodes, but then it doesn't hit you or any of your flight mates.
What altitudes were you generally flying at that allowed you to pitch over like that?
Roughly 20,000, I would say somewhere between 15 and 20,000 feet. That was a good maneuvering airspace for the F-4 Phantom. Okay, so we're flying about there, and you could really then push over, start down, and it's when the missile commits to you is when you then need to turn and pull into it, and you put a lot of G's on the aircraft doing that. So, yeah, it would work.
That's unbelievable. So tell me about flying the F4, because that is a beast of an
It
aircraft.
is, but a great machine. I mean, and being that beast saved a lot of our lives. It could take a beating. I've been hit by gunfire and get back to land at Da Nang, not knowing that I had been hit, and get back and look at the aircraft and go, oh goodness, you'll get holes that big in the aircraft, and if it doesn't hit a fuel line, an electrical cable, a flight cable, flight control cable, or something like that, the airplane is going to fly. It has these massive J79 engines in it, made by GE. Just a great machine. The one thing though that for some reason wasn't figured out is we burned JP4 in the F4, and it left the smoke trail. So when a whole flight of F4 started heading north, the Vietnamese could see us from miles away. Yeah, I really could see us from miles away because of the fuel that we were burning. I'm not so sure why we didn't figure that out and got a different fuel to burn, like maybe JP5 or JP8 or something like that, which the Navy was using. So they didn't have near that problem as we did.
Wow, the opposite of stealth.
Yeah, that's for sure. Totally the opposite of stealth. Yep.
So tell me about your, I guess, your last mission, and then how you transitioned between then and the Thunderbirds.
Yeah, I had my last missions in Vietnam the first part of April of 1969. Got on a commercial airplane in at Da Nang. I can't remember whether it was a Pan Am, what the airline was. Probably Airways, I guess, was an airline called Airways at that time. Where we called it the Freedom Bird, where a whole bunch of us GIs get on the aircraft. And you just wait for that day all year long. And the rules for the flyers were either you could come home after 100 missions north or 1 year of time in country, whichever came first. Because we stopped going up north when I hit about 75 missions, I thought I was going to be home in like for Christmas of 68. Well, then they stopped going up north in November. So I didn't get home until April of 69. But get on the bird, flew back home, landed at Norton Air Force Base in California. Finally got back home to join up with my family, mom and dad, and my wife, and first child at the time. We're all there to welcome me home. And then after that, I'd already knew that I wanted to be a Thunderbird because I saw the Thunderbirds when I was at Tennessee State for the very first time at an air show. So all along, I'm thinking, how do I build my flying time to meet the qualifications for coming on the team? And then after Vietnam, I was assigned in the Philippines, and then finally for 3 years, and then to Luke Air Force Base. But all of this time, I'm building my hours and to because you needed 1,000 hours of flight time to apply for the team, unconditional flying status, and those kinds of things. So I applied the first time when I was in the Philippines, and made it to the semifinalists. Didn't make it to the finalists. Came back, competed, against a whole group of other applicants, probably about 30 of us, I guess, by that time, because they had already narrowed it down to the semifinalists. So I didn't make it that year. Back to the Philippines, flew for another year, applied the second time. Came the second time, visited with the team, flew with them. So I made the semifinalists, I made the finalists, and they said, okay, go home, we'll call you. So I get a call back in the Philippines, like 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that, from a guy by the name of Jerry Bolt, which was a slot pilot on the team at the time. Jerry said, sorry, Fig, you didn't make the Thunderbirds this time, but be sure to apply again next year. In the meantime, I rotate to the States, and I'm an instructor pilot at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, and I apply for the third time. And sure enough, I make the semifinalists, I make the finalists, I go fly with the team, and they say, go home, we'll give you a call after we make a decision, on who's going to be on the team. So I did. And one day I was out as an instructor for a guy a lot of people know that may be with us this evening, a guy by the name of Chuck DeBellevue. Chuck DeBellevue had already been in Vietnam as a backseater and as a navigator. He has now become a pilot, and he is learning how to fly in the front seat of the F-4. I was one of Chuck's instructor pilots. So we're out on the range. I get a call from the squadron and says, hey, you have this call from the Thunderbirds. Why don't you return, you know, turn to base? I told Chuck, I said, Chuck, I've had this call two times before, and it wasn't good news. I don't see any reason for us to rush back in, you know? So we didn't. We finished the mission. And we got back in. We were sitting in the debriefing. I'm debriefing him. Phone call comes in. They called me to the front desk. And sure enough, this time it wasn't Jerry Bolt. It was Roger Parrish, who was the commander leader of the team. And he said, hey, Fig, this is Roger Parrish. Congratulations. You made the 1975 Thunderbird team. I don't know what much happened after that, you know, but I went kind of crazy, I guess, there in the squadron. So it was in late 1974 when I got selected for the Thunderbirds. And that November, I was out, started my training. I narrated the first year and flew in the slot position the next 2 years while I was on the team. And by now, we've transitioned, the Thunderbirds had already transitioned out of the F-4 Phantom, which I thought I was going to be flying with them, and now they're flying the T-38. All of this happened because of the energy crunch that came along during that time in the United States.
That's so amazing. Put such a smile on my face here that I want to show that this is, when was this image taken?
That was taken in 1969, that photo. I'm about to go on a combat mission. I'm standing right next to an F-4 Phantom aircraft.
Yeah, you can tell because most of the engines, again, those things are so big. They used to be my absolute favorite plane when I was a kid growing up, just due to the sheer power involved in those. And then, of course, here is the hero shot.
Yeah, that's it.
With the Thunderbirds.
Yeah. So this picture would have been taken in 1976. Because 75, again, I that year, I was the spokesperson for the team. I was the narrator, so I was really the voice. I did all the advanced work. I was usually ahead of the team at any location where we're going to put on a demonstration by at least 3 hours to be sure that we have everything we need when the team gets there. And then in 76, 77, I was flying in the slot position, which was the position I really wanted to fly in. When you're looking at this photo, that's the second one from the lead aircraft here in front. So I'm flying directly behind the lead aircraft.
And do you feel that? That's a tight, tight position to be in. You've got one person pushing you from behind, one person in front of you.
Yeah, but most of the time it's just four of us. So I'm the one behind, right behind the leader, and then the two wingmen are on the left and right side of the leader. And so I can feel his downwash that's coming off of his aircraft. And he can feel me a lot of times too, particularly if I get too close under the bottom there. But when I'm flying back there, I'm overlapping his aircraft about 6 feet and I'm below him about 4 feet.
Wow, that is amazingly close. So tell me about what it's like flying the T-38. I mean, the Talon people, they just describe it with such loving terms.
Yeah, I love the aircraft. I flew it several times during my time in the Air Force, obviously when I was in flight training, then with the Thunderbirds. But in my last command, well, there were two commands. When I was a wing commander at Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma, I flew and instructed student pilots in the T-38 as well. And I'll come back to that one in a minute. And then when I rotated a couple years later, I'm now down at Randolph as the Air Education and Training Command commander, a four-star position, and that was the airplane that I was qualified in, the T-38. So it's again, it's just a wonderful, very forgiving aircraft. You know, we can fly it all the way up to about 45,000 feet, depending on what the weather is like up there. And it can fly along. It's a Mach 1 aircraft. And so many times we were up there flying at 0.9 Mach, 540, 580 miles per hour or so.
Wow.
Kind of moving.
and the thing is, it just looks fast, even sitting on the ramp.
Yeah, but it's a very, like I said, very straightforward airplane to fly and to learn. And so every time I would go away from it and come back to the aircraft, it was very much like, you know, getting on the bicycle. Very shortly, you're totally familiar with it again. Very efficient aircraft, trained a number of pilots in that aircraft over the years, since about the early 60s, we started flying that in the training command. Yeah.
What was your favorite thing about flying in the with the Thunderbirds?
Oh, the camaraderie of the folks that you're flying with. And a lot of folks would say to me, boy, that really seemed to be dangerous. And I would say, no, this is probably the safest flying I've ever done, is flying with the Thunderbirds. And the reason is because you're flying with the same people every single time you go out the flying. Sometimes, particularly during training season, you know, we're flying twice a day, 5 and 6 days a week. And so, you know, in 1976, we were scheduled to fly 106 air shows around the country and in the Canada, including up into Alaska. I've also been fortunate enough to land the first T-38 in Alaska.
Really?
Yeah, sure did. So this was in 1975. Again, we were going to do a show in Alaska, and we're launching out of Canada. We were doing a show in Abbotsford for Canada. And so I'm in front of the team. So I landed at a little airport called Ketchikan. And right on the side of a mountain. And if you're not very careful, it's not a place you want to be, you know? So, but anyway, the aircraft was pretty extraordinary. Yeah, to fly.
That's so amazing. Now, as the first African-American member of the Thunderbirds, how conscious was that, and how much did that play a role in your daily life and the air shows and the tours that you did?
Yeah, when I first joined the team, the press made it a real big deal. I mean, you know, for us who had, I'd already been in the military by that time, about 10 and a half years or so. So, you know, my teammates and all of that, this is not a big deal for them or for me personally, as we are interacting. It's what the American public thinks and sees, and particularly the press. So when we would land when I initially got on the team, every time we would land at a new location, you know, the press would come out, and normally the press comes out and they want to talk to the command, the leader. We were expecting for them to talk to the leader of the team. Well, then the press would come immediately over to me, you know, and start wanting to talk to me. And so when this first started happening, one of the very first questions is, hey, how's the flight in? And then the very next question is, how is it to be the first African-American on the team? What's that feel like, you know? And it finally occurred to me, you know, this is not what Fig Newton feels when he's the first African-American. It's what my teammates really feel. And so they would ask me that question. I would say, well, I'm not really sure. Why don't you ask one of my teammates, what do they feel about me being on the team? And that blew their minds. Like, it just completely blew their minds, you know.
That's a very, very interesting way of looking at it. I mean, I'd like to dive into this a little bit further, because certainly in your book, Living the Dream, you talk about your growth and how, and this, you know, breaking those bonds of segregation and disenfranchisement as when you grew up in the 60s. And tell me a little bit about your experience and how that meant, you know, the regular world versus the military and what your experience was during that.
Yeah, be glad to. Particularly for folks who are listening, you know, if you think back to Vietnam and during that period of time, we're talking about the 60s now. There was a lot of, you know, racial tension and strife that went on in the nation during that period of time. And so the military is no different in that regard than our civilian community. Why? All of our men and women come from our civilian community. So they bring with them whatever they were taught or told or what have you to the military. So it's then the military's responsibility, if we want to have good unit cohesion and the core in the force, we found that, hey, we really need to face this issue head on. So I was part of an initial cadre of people around the Air Force, and the other services were doing basically the same thing, who started then to develop programs so that people will have an opportunity in, quote, quote, a controlled environment to have a discussion about these issues, about the myth and all of that, the misunderstanding of why folks act the way they did or respond the way they did and so on. And so I was part of an initial cadre who helped to build, and I was stationed at Clark Air Base in the Philippines at the time, which had 10,000 GIs, and with the families and all that, roughly 40, 45,000 people on the base on any one given day. I mean, that's a large community, okay? And so we built those programs, sought race relation classes, brought in the senior leadership on the base, and went through classes with them. And it was amazing what we accomplished by doing that. Because for the very first time, it really got all of us to talking to each other and to better understand how we got to where we were, okay? Mm. And out of that experience, when folks ask me about this today, so, well, what, gee whiz, you know, well, what is it that you were really trying to get? What was it you want? And the answer to that is, what we really want is to ensure that we have fair, equal, and equitable opportunity for everybody, everywhere, every time, 24 hours a day, no exceptions. That's the why we're all Americans. We're all on the same team. And that's the way it really should be for the nation. So I'm very proud of that experience, and I would put my United States Air Force, when it comes to these kinds of issues, and it's not that we solved them all, still haven't solved them all, but we're far down the road of solving so many of these and understanding them better. So I would put my United States Air Force up against any institution, and for sure, any institution of our size, when it comes to these kinds of issues, we'll win every single time.
Wow.
I would do it all over again if I had the opportunity.
It seems that the military is an ideal environment to tackle issues such as racism, sexism, equity, in a very positive way. Because can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And again, we have that opportunity. And the reason being is, we have a bit more control than you do, say, in civilian, let's take a civilian company that's trying to, you know, work these issues. Well, they can't order someone or say, and cannot take that kind of punitive action as easily as we can in the military if everybody's not playing by the same rules, you know. And you can't do this in isolation. I mean, you just can't take one group and say, okay, what do you want? And then go out and try to do that. No, you have to, as I mentioned earlier, be sure that all of us are talking, okay, and trying to understand, how do we get to that point where all of us are fully understanding that we're going to treat folks, no matter who you are, where you came from, what you look like, you know, what ethnicity you happen to be, because none of us have any control over that as individuals ourselves. We are who we are, you know. And, but as a commander, I could say, and we did, you know, my commanders back at that time says, hey, guess what? Here's the way the rules are. We're just not going to stand for folks to use racially charged words. That's just not going to happen. I can't catch you doing that. I'm going to take punitive action. And we did. Okay. We did. It doesn't take long for that to get around that says, you know what, that's probably not a good thing to do. And it wasn't. Folks, then you'd find people start to talk to each other. I'm involved. I launched a charter school here in my little hometown in southern South Carolina, okay? And as a part of that process, I laid out very clearly to my board that, hey, guess what? Any of these subjects that come up, we're going to meet them head on. And it doesn't make any difference who our students happen to be. They're all going to get fair and equitable treatment. They and their families are going to all be treated the same. Okay, no difference, no excuses, no exceptions, and doesn't need to be. We've been very successful.
That's fantastic. There seems to be a pretty significant divide in terms of the thought process when it comes to trying to achieve those goals. There seems to be something, an area that I think most everyone I've met agrees with, which is that idea of what you just said, of having equality treated the same respect, the same rules, the same opportunities, so that you wind up with the best fighting force or the best civilization. And then there's also a narrative of sort of promoting people or advancing people, you know, based solely on background or solely on ethnic or sex or other types of things, where it gets this negative connotation that it certainly, you know, sort of harms the world. How do you balance that in that positive way? How do we achieve that goal and change that narrative?
Yeah, I'm not so sure I have a good answer for you, how you change the narrative. And I fully understand what you're talking about, because we've been battling that particular thought for long. Because, you know, every once in a while, folks will say, well, gee whiz, you know, well, if you allow this total integration, this total equality across the board, then we're going to have a force that is not capable. That has not been proven to be that way at all. I mean, what a great falsehood that is. We don't lower the standards. When I was in training command, as well as my entire time in the Air Force, which is 34 and a half years, I'm not aware of any standards that was lowered so that we could just bring in a particular group of folks or get folks in a particular area. There's a standard that needs to be set for the requirement to get the job done, okay? And that is the standard. That standard is not, you know, it's like most standards, it's someplace in about the middle. It's not the lowest standard, it's not the highest standard for a requirement to get the job done. And if that's so that you can give everybody then an equal opportunity to you know, participate. And it's all about, in my mind, and it's been proven, it's all about giving folks an opportunity to perform and to demonstrate that they can perform, okay? And if we do that across the board, we will continue to be a great country and even better than what we are now. Because we are better now than we were in 1960. And if we do it right, we'll be better 10 years from now, 20 years from now. But you do have to provide, as I was saying earlier, what is wrong with fair and equitable treatment for everybody? Yeah. Not giving one group an advantage over the other. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. But if, you know, if I'm capable of doing the job, why don't I have an opportunity to do that? And if I'm capable of being in a position, why wouldn't I have the opportunity to do that? So I get asked quite often, have you ever been discriminated against while you're in the military? There are a few occasions that I could share with you, no need to do that here, share with you that, yeah, clearly in my mind, I was being discriminated against. But that's not what bothers me, you know? What really bothers me is the things that I don't know, where there was a board for promotion or for command or whatever that was being, you know, being held. And what was said there when there wasn't someone there that looked like me to represent me and folks like me in that community. So you don't really know whether you're being discriminated or not, you know, in some, yeah, of those instances.
I think it's a really powerful message, and I think that concept, that negative kind of sort of a story that goes along, that of this idea that it all boils down to two candidates in front of someone choosing one, and the lesser qualified candidate is chosen. Like that's the simply because of their race or their sex or their religion, yeah. whatever. Yeah. There's this idea that we become less because of that. And yet from everyone I've ever interviewed, like yourself, who've accomplished all these things and seen it from the inside, it's absolutely not that scenario. That's not the narrative. The reality is it's about casting this wide net so you get the best. Yeah. So you get the best of the people that you never would have talked to.
Sure. I can, you know, and just talking about me, I work hard going through flight school. I mean, it wasn't a cakewalk for me at all. And all the way along, I mean, we were talking about with me getting on the Thunderbirds. I mean, you know, they were selecting the best candidate that came along at that period of time. That's why I wasn't selected the first two times. That's the way the process worked. That's the way it should work. When it got to my point, I was the best candidate to come along. And there were a lot of folks, and that's why the press wanted to talk to me. You know, did you get selected because you're an African-American? No, I got selected because I was the pilot that was most qualified at the time.
Have you seen the same thing when it comes to, for example, women? There's been a lot of talk in the news about it being in combat roles and frontline combat roles and whether or not something like that changes. But you've seen the history of that.
Sure. Not only have I seen the history of it, I train a number of women, okay, in combat airplanes. And the first woman, Jeannie, was then Jeannie Flynn, that came in to go fly F-15s, I trained Jeannie Flynn. Jeannie Flynn showed up at my base probably in 1992, somewhere about there. I was at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. Jeannie came in and the press said, okay, we want to come out and interview her every week. And I said, do you come out and interview the guys every week that come here for training? They said, no. I said, then you're not going to interview Jeannie every week. I tell you what, we're going to have a deal here. You're going to speak to her, and you can ask her any question you want when she first arrived. I'll arrange for a press conference. And whenever she leaves this space, whether she makes it through this training or not, we'll have another press conference. That's exactly what we did. Jeannie went through the course and now is a two-star general. I think Jeannie just recently retired as a two-star general. So, we don't just give folks two stars, they have to earn it, okay?
Wow. So speaking of education, of course, you went on to head up the United States Air Force Air Education and Training Command. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So Education and Training Command, we were responsible for all of the initial training and advanced training for all of the folks who came into the Air Force. And during that period of time, particularly for our enlisted force, we were enlisting 45,000 men and women in the United States Air Force every single year. And I was also in that command responsible for all the recruiting. So had all of the training, all the recruiting, all of the education. And it just was fascinating, you know. And, I come from a fighter pilot background. And so instead of going to be the commander of a large fighter organization like Air Combat Command or something like that, I'm in the training command. So now I have to think about, okay, so what is it that you really want to leave as a legacy here? What I really had to think about was the Air Force of, you know, 10 years from now, 15, 20 years from now, is going to be the Air Force that Fig Newton was responsible for training. And we took that on. And it just, you know, just really made all of the sense in the world that this Air Force that I was training and helping to build, because these new recruits were coming in, these young officers were coming in the flight school and then into other training, whether that's to be maintenance officers or what have you, all of those folks retrained. And every academic course that was being taught, including the medical side of the business, that was in training command. So I was responsible, me and my team, because one person doesn't do this, okay? You have to have this team of people around you that help you to carry out this mission. And I had some extraordinary people to help do this. They did some extraordinary work. So it wasn't about Fig Newton. It was about all of us as a team. And what I felt my responsibility was, is to be sure that I can create an environment where every single man, woman, and even their family felt like they were full team members on that team, okay? It didn't make any difference whether it was a young airman who just came in on yesterday They're working in my organization. They had a role to play, and I wanted to be sure that they felt that their role was really important, because it was. Absolutely, because it was. They were just, and my philosophy was, there isn't anybody in this organization of that 45,000 GIs plus all of our civilians, there isn't anybody in this organization that are more important than the other. No one, I'm not any more important than anybody else here. Nobody. Okay. I have a different rank that gives me a different set of responsibilities, but you, as a young airman, you are just as important as I am as the commander. And as a man, I tried to create that environment such that they felt that kind of responsibility and value and respect so that they could get their jobs done. And they did it, and they did it very, very well.
That's very, very impressive. And it just seems like a great environment for anyone to work and to learn and to be able to succeed, for not just the people who work there, but of course the ultimate product of training that and what you're leaving them with. Because I feel like the strategy and the mantra and your values in how you are leading your own people is exactly what you're imparting to the students.
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And you know, I'm just so very pleased and thankful for the opportunity to have served for those 34 and a half years, because there are many times now I may be in an airport or I'll show up someplace and somebody will come up to me and says, I know you don't remember me, but I was in your command wherever I happen to be. And I you know, worked for you, I served with you, and I had a good experience. That just makes my whole day, because then it makes me feel like I really made a contribution to our Air Force, to our nation, and to the world, so far as that.
That's truly wonderful. So you mentioned that in order to educate, you have to look forward and look forward 10 years, see what's going to be happening. I'm curious to what your thoughts are on, even as a civilian now, what your thoughts are looking forward and what the United States Air Force and our air power is going to mean in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, because there's a lot of talk of elimination of piloted aircraft, or mm-hmm. is it all going to be complementary? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the technology that we've developed, both as a part of the military institution as well as our civilian counterparts, whether that's the large military industrial companies or what have you, have brought some technology to us that really changes the formula of how we engage in combat. I mean, it's amazing when you start to look at World War II and the number of airplanes, number of individuals that we lost in the war, and including Vietnam, and now look at what happened in places like Desert Storm and so on. It really changed dynamics. And so, for us folks like myself who were fighter pilots, like we like to get out there and engage and mix it up with an enemy aircraft and so on. However, from a nation standpoint, it may not be the right set of tools for a given mission that needs to go. So if it's other equipment like a drone of some type or what have you that can get the job done, why should we risk an American life to go do that when you can do it? So I really see this all playing out, and I honestly do not personally have a problem with whatever that mix happened to be. Somehow we're still going to have human in the loop, whether it's back on the ground helping to control those. And you got to have people who can think about how you engage in warfare and be able to win. Okay, that is the final and the ultimate objective here, is how do you do that? And you want to do that with the least loss of American lives. And that's what commanders really have to continue to think about, of how we make that happen with our civilian leadership understanding that part of it as well.
That makes sense. And while we're talking about lives, I don't want to, get to the end of the show without talking about your brothers, because even though as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, you didn't come from a family of military or of pilots, you sure made one.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I was the first one to come in. No one in my near family, like my father or brothers or even close uncles, that were in the military. But I came in, and then the brother behind me, my brother Lester, he came in. All of us went to Tennessee State. And then our youngest brother, Don, he also came in. He was at Tennessee State as well. All of us were in flying. Both Lester and I were pilots, and Don was a weapons controller in AWACS. And you know, we'd all sometimes show up at home together. Drove my mom completely crazy because she would say, well, oh my goodness, my children are flying, you know, this dangerous atmosphere that they're working in. But all three of us were in. We lost my brother Lester in 1985. He was in the aircraft with General Jerome O'Malley, the commander of Tactical Air Command at the time, in a T-39 aircraft up in Pennsylvania. And unfortunately, the aircraft had a brake malfunction. They couldn't stop the aircraft. They tried to take off. We had General O'Malley and an instructor pilot at the controls. My brother was sitting in the back with Mrs. O'Malley and the crew chief. And unfortunately, the airplane went off the end of the runway, burst into a ball of flame, and we lost all five people. Now, some folks usually would say, oh, I'm so sorry about that. And what I would say, and what I always say is, no need to be sorry. My brother was doing exactly like me, doing what he loved doing. He loved flying airplanes, and he certainly went away in good company, you know, because mm-hmm. General O'Malley was just an extraordinary general officer and leader and all of that. So it was a big loss for us in the Air Force, particularly at that time, to lose a leader like that, as well as with my brother. But that's comes with the territory, you know, yeah. It just does. Yeah.
So. Well, I do want to show for anybody who wants to see your story again, your book, Living the Dream, is available on Amazon. So be sure to check that out to really get a little bit more of your background and your story from your life, which is truly, truly fascinating. We have come to the part of the show where we like to do something called Social Flight's Fast Five. Would you be up for five questions to get people to know you in a little bit more of a snapshot condensed format?
Yeah, let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens.
Okay, here we go. General Lloyd W. Fig Newton, this is your Social Flight's Fast Five. Five questions to get to know you a little bit better. And we're going to start with question number one, which is, you've flown quite a few aircraft ranging from the Cub in civilian life all the way up to the stealth fighter. What was your favorite of all those? What's the experience that really, the one you want?
Well, thanks for the question. And I get that question a lot. Well, I tell you, all of them are fantastic airplanes, including the Cub, including the J-3 Piper. But if you put them all out on the flight line, and say, okay, go jump in when we're going to fly, I would probably go out and jump in the F-16. F-16, when I flew that aircraft, it was a sports car of the sky and just had tremendous capabilities as well. Not that the others didn't, but this was definitely the sports car of the sky I would fly down.
Wow, and one that has stood the test of time and just continues to fly around the world.
Right.
Excellent. All right, question number two. Was there either a scary or very impactful moment of your life that you believe you learned something significant from?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are probably several of them, you know. That experience in Vietnam, for instance, and I you know, again, I left from the country right in the height of, I'll tell you what the day I left. I left on the 4th of April, 1968. Now, that rings a bell for a lot of folks because that's the day that Dr. Martin Luther King got killed. I wasn't sure I really should be heading to Vietnam at that very moment because I was in San Francisco when that happened, about to get on an airplane within hours to head to Vietnam. So that event really had a significant impact on me. However, I made a commitment that I was going to go and serve in the United States Air Force and go to Vietnam. And so that's what I did, and I don't regret that decision. However, when I was in Vietnam, it became very clear to me that the United States of America was by far the best country in the world. And I made up my mind when I came back that I was going to continue to do everything within my power to keep it that way and to make it better. That's what my life story has been all about.
That is fantastic. What a wonderful story and message to have as a mission for your life. Okay, question number three. If you had the opportunity to go back and just re-experience some moment of your life, put yourself back for 15 minutes or so, not to change it, just to soak it in, what would that be?
I would probably, because I enjoyed so much being around those new recruits and those young folks who were just coming in to be a part of this great institution, I would probably want to go back to the training command. Even though I flew fighters, clearly enjoyed that. I enjoyed flying the F-117 stealth fighter at night and all of that kind of neat stuff. But again, leadership and to get, accomplish what we need to accomplish, it's all about the people. And so we can get the people and have them inspired to accomplish these missions, we will win hands down. I don't care who we're going up against. So if I could go back for a moment, I'd go back to the training command. I want to be with our new recruits that's coming in at Lackland Air Force Base. I would want to go to our flight training bases and have another flight in airplanes with them, and so on. So that's really what I would love to go back and do.
The human connection and leadership, I absolutely love that.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is what makes it all really come together.
Okay, question number four. If you had the opportunity to go back in time and give some advice to your younger self back in your teens or 20s, what do you think you'd say?
I would say to myself, particularly when I moved into those initial command positions and so on, you're working so hard to try to be sure that you're going to do the mission and do it right, that I don't think I allowed myself to relax just a little bit and enjoy the moment. Because I didn't think about it then. I never really thought about it until after I left. You're really going to get only one opportunity to do many of those jobs that I was in. Just one. And so I would like to just go back again and say, okay, breathe for a moment now and enjoy the moment that you're here and life as it is. I that's what I would do. Just to soak up some more of that satisfaction of serving the nation.
I absolutely love that. That's wonderful. What a great sentiment. Okay, and our last question, question number five. If you could choose anyone, living or no longer with us, current history, anyone at all, to spend an evening with, who comes to mind?
Oh, wow. I've been fortunate to spend a lot of time with a lot of different people that are notable. And I'm trying to think of who would really come to mind right now. I'm searching for who that is. I don't know. Again, I've had the opportunity to spend time with, for instance, Chuck Yeager, who's just a fascinating individual. And I spent time with a number of the astronauts and, their experience of going into space and back and so on. So
I think a life well lived, if no one comes to mind, that's just a good thing.
I've been fortunate to be able to be around, but for instance, Neil Armstrong. I've sat and had the opportunity to sit and talk with Neil Armstrong. What a fascinating individual, certainly an American icon that has done so much. And what I really like about Neil, and there are several other folks that I try to emulate my lifestyle with, is Neil was just so humble, just so very humble. If you didn't know Neil was an astronaut, if somebody didn't really tell you, you'd never learn that by just talking to Neil.
That's impressive.
That's just the kind of guy he was. And that's what I want to be and continue to be. It's not about Big Newton, a four-star general. I want to just be about Big Newton, who I am as an individual. So,
well, that has been my experience. I am absolutely grateful that we met, that we spent time together. I look forward to seeing you in person sometime soon, and And thank you so, so much for taking time to share your story and your thoughts and your perspective on our country and the world with us here on Social Flight Live.
Well, it's been my great honor. I wish everyone out there a very happy holiday. Just be safe. And again, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Absolutely. You take care. Thank you so much, everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah.
General Lloyd Fig Newton. Have a good evening.
Take care now.
Thank you. And thank you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday evening with our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff. That's a separate show. In order to register for that, go to cockpit, the number two, and the word cowl, cockpit2cowl.com. Sign up for that show. We're going to talk all about winter, flying winter, maintenance, preparing for winter. That's our theme as we go into that show. It's a lot of fun while the two of us banter back and forth about both piloting and maintenance. And then Social Flight Live is back on Tuesday, December 17th with Major General Ratiff, the Director of Operations for the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD. It's going to be here for the show that we do once a year. It is absolutely wonderful, and it's going to be a great opportunity to talk about some strategic things about what is happening in the northern part of our two countries between Canada and the United States against other countries and seeing intrusions, etc. We got a lot of info when we talk to NORAD. And in addition to that, of course, we'll wrap up with talking about their Santa tracker and all the fun that they do around all that. So I look forward to seeing you next Tuesday and also on Tuesday, the December 17th. And I thank all of you for taking time and joining us here again on Social Flight Live. Until next time, I wish you all blue skies.